Horse of a Different Color by Ralph Moody, University of Nebraska Press, 1968. Thank you, God, that I have time to sit here tonight and to read this chapter, to enjoy the new year, the weekend, and now to be ready for worship tomorrow. So I do pray for each of the kids and the grandkids. They'll be listening to this long after this particular Sabbath or Sunday is over. But I pray, Father, that they would weekly set aside time to be still, to delight in who you are as God, and to worship, to gather with the entire family that's where they are, and that they would delight in sitting under the preaching of the word and joining with the body there. In Jesus' name, amen. So chapter 24, forgot to tell you that. Dr. DeMay's discovery. From the time I quit my diet and went onto beefsteak, potatoes, and hot biscuits three times a day, I'd been putting on weight at about the same rate as the hogs in my pasture. I'd never once gone to see Dr. DeMay and might have stayed away months longer if it hadn't been for the sheep deal and so few people coming to pick up meat packages on weekday evenings. Nick always retreated to his sanctuary right after supper and never came out until he was sure there'd be no more customers. That left me alone from 6 till 8:30 with only a few interruptions when someone came for packages. I'd gradually fallen into the habit of writing to Edna every evening, and she'd always answered. Our letters weren't love letters, just more or less visiting on paper, but each one added fuel to my rekindled affection for her. I'd been careful to keep it from showing in my letters, but by mid-October, I longed for her more than anything I'd ever wanted in my life. Tuesdays were my paydays. The mail always brought my weekly meat check from the railroad and my agent's check for the livestock I shipped on Saturday. In August, I paid off my loan to the Farmers National and my hog mortgage to the receiver of the Cedar Bluffs Bank. Since then, I had been whittling away at my debt by turning over to him each Tuesday the balance of my account in excess of $3,000. The reduction had been slow, however, for the accounts on my books had increased from week to week, and the payments had all been in nubbin corn or livestock of almost every type and description. It ranged from weanling calves and 50-pound pigs to 400-pound sows and 1,000-pound dry sows. The only thing I could do was to put them in pasture, feed them, and let them accumulate until I had enough of some particular type to ship a carload, and the market slipped steadily downward. A few days after I sold my two carloads of bacon hogs at the end of July, the market fell off sharply. By the end of September, hog prices had dropped $4 a hundred, but I'd been hurt very little by it. Almost invariably, it was shoats or overweight sows that were turned in on the meat accounts. I used the sows for butchering, so had no shipping expense on them, and the shoats I turned into the pasture. For every 60 I took in, I shipped out a carload that had grown from shoats to bacon hogs since I bought them. By early September, I'd taken in more nubbin corn than my hogs could eat. So put 60 good steers in the feedlot. They'd done extremely well and were the ones I'd been shipping when I became a sheep owner for 2 seconds. The sheep windfall was $258. The steers made a profit of nearly $400. My railroad business that week was larger than usual, and when the checks came in on Tuesday, I was able to take the first big slice off my debt. On the 15th of October, George Miner helped me round up inventory and set a value on every head of livestock in my pasture. The first thing after supper, I went over the accounts on my books, adding them up and making allowances for any that I had the least doubt of collecting. To my amazement, I found that my assets, conservatively valued, were within approximately $1,800 of my debts, and there were still 6 weeks until the end of the railroad contract. Unless there was another flood or the place burned down, I was certain to be out of debt before the end of the year. I was so happy that I couldn't keep it up to myself, and that evening I wrote Edna a dozen pages, telling her about all my financial ups and downs since coming to Kansas. I told her of my big hauling, trading, and feeding profits, and of losing everything when the livestock market collapsed in the fall of 1920, of gaining back during the winter and spring of 1921, only to be cleaned out by the flood in June, of thinking I was hopelessly ruined when the court ruled that I was liable for Bob's debts, and about the streak of good luck I'd been riding ever since. I wound the letter up by bragging that I'd made more than $1,000 in the past week would be completely out of debt before Thanksgiving, had gained 60 pounds, and was never healthier in my life. Then I read the letter over, threw it in the stove, and set a match to it. The next morning, I saved the first specimen after getting up, the one doctors always wanted for testing, took it with me when I made the railroad delivery, and drove straight to McCook. I was waiting outside Dr. DeMay's office when he arrived, but he didn't recognize me until I spoke, and then seemed startled as if he'd seen a ghost. For more than a minute, he stood looking me over from head to foot and back again. "Well, son," he said at last, "I've been wondering why you quit me, but I don't wonder anymore. Whoever your physician is now, don't leave him. I never saw anything like it in my life." He looked even more astonished when I told him that I hadn't been to any doctor and that I'd been living on beefsteak, potatoes, and hot biscuits for 3 months. "Humph," the old doctor snorted. "There's something here that doesn't G. Did you bring along a specimen?" "Yes, sir," I told him. "The first one this morning." He snatched the bottle from me and ran up the stairs to his office as though he were 16 instead of in his 60s. Calling back over his shoulder, "This is the most curious thing I've heard of in medical practice. Take a chair by my desk while I run a couple of tests. If anybody else comes, tell them to wait outside." For 20 minutes, the only sounds were the tinkle of glass or an occasional snort from the doctor's laboratory room. He didn't say a word when he came out, but sat down at the desk and thumbed back through the book in which he always made notes after testing my specimens. Suddenly, he whirled his swivel chair around and began firing questions at me as though he were a lawyer cross-examining a key witness in a murder trial. After a dozen or more that I don't remember, he asked, "How many analyses of your urine had been made before the first one in which sugar was discovered?" "None," I told him. "There was never anything wrong with me before that except a leaky heart and a few broken bones." "How many carbuncles did you have last spring?" 39, I said. He ran a finger under an entry in the journal and said, "Kind of petered out toward the end, didn't they?" "Yes, sir," I said. "The last few were only cat boils." He hummed as if pleased with the answer and said, "Now tell me, how much have you been worrying of late?" "None," I said with a grin. "I haven't had much to worry about for the past couple of months." A smile flickered at the corners of his mouth and he said, "So I hear." Then he drew his brows together in a frown and asked, "Didn't you think your health was something to worry about after quitting your diet without medical advice?" "I haven't had much time for worrying since then," I told him. "Besides, I've gained nearly a pound a day and never felt better or stronger in my life." Dr. DeMay sat for a minute, staring down at his desk and tapping it with a stubby finger, then looked up and told me, "As I said before, this is the most curious case I've come across in medical practice. There isn't one iota's variation in the sugar content of the specimen I just tested, and the one you brought me when you first came in here 2 years ago." For another minute, the white-thatched doctor sat tapping his desk, then swung toward me and rested his elbows on his knees. "Within the past few months, a synthetic insulin had been developed and is now in the experimental stage," he told me. "A little of it injected into the bloodstream has been found to give temporary relief from diabetes, retarding the breakdown of proteins and enabling the body to utilize fats and sugars. But there's no known cure for the disease, and I never heard of it curing itself. Still and all, you've made a miraculous recovery. That is, if you were ever in bad enough shape to justify that Boston prognosis. And the more I think about it, the more I doubt it. Now, you understand I'm no specialist at diabetes, and what I'm going to tell you is simply a country doctor's opinion. But it's the only way I can make sense or reason out of this thing. First off, though I don't hold too much with Christian Science, I do believe that a lot of physical ills are brought on and aggravated by state of mind. When you first came to me, you'd made a lot of money hauling wheat, hadn't you, and didn't have a worry in the world, outside of the sentence those Boston specialists had dished out to you. That's right, I said. Your specimen showed little more than a trace of sugar then, and remained about the same until last December. Then the content doubled. Wasn't that when the livestock market broke, and from then till after the time you saw me in June, weren't you worrying yourself about half sick? I had plenty to worry about, I told him. Now, when did you quit worrying, he asked, before or after you quit your diet? About the same time, I said. Thought so. I'm not going to say there's any connection, but there just might be. And there's another might be. When I was a boy, the old-time country doctors used to say that a carbuncle was worth $10 to a man. boiled the poison out of his system, and purified his blood. I never found scientific proof of it, but those old-timers got results with lots of remedies that have never been approved by modern science. If there's anything to the theory, your blood sure got a purging at about the time of the flood. I'm not saying that had anything to do with your improvement, but I'm not ruling that out either. Then there's a third possibility, and that's the one I'm inclined towards. Though I've never run into a case, there is such a thing as incipient diabetes. As I recall, it has all the symptoms of true diabetes, but it's more a malfunction than a disease. In true diabetes, the pancreas fails to secrete insulin, the substance that enables the human body to absorb and make use of fats and sugars. In incipient diabetes, the insulin is secreted, the body absorbs and utilizes fats in the normal manner, but just as the valve in the heart malfunctions to let a little blood pass, the kidneys, Dr. DeMay broke off mid-sentence, clasped both hands behind his head, and sat gazing at the ceiling for 2 or 3 minutes. Then, as though a spring had suddenly been released, he sprang to his feet and demanded, "Were you in the war?" "No, sir. I was rejected because of a leaky heart," I said. "What were you doing when your health failed?" he snapped. "I was a carpenter at a munitions plant when I began losing weight," I told him, "but I wasn't really sick." "How much did you lose?" "About 60 pounds. "In how short a time?" "About 4 months." The old doctor clasped his hands across his rotund belly and paced back and forth across the little office. "Did you eat 3 good square meals a day?" he asked. "Not always. The summer of 1918 was hot in Delaware, and I wasn't always hungry at mealtime." "Get in much overtime?" "Quite a bit," I told him. "I wanted to save as much money as I could while the big pay lasted." Dr. DeMay stopped pacing, whirled, and demanded sharply, "How many days a week were you working?" 7. "How many hours a week?" "Sometimes as few as 70 and occasionally 90. Usually about 84. "Now we're getting somewhere," he sang out. "Exhaustion. Exhaustion and malnutrition. There's our answer." Dr. DeMay sat down again, leaned forward, and told me, "Somewhere in the back of my head, I had a recollection that incipient diabetes was the result of exhaustion and malnutrition, but was stumped for any authority until I remembered a lecture I attended during my internship. This lecturer, and I can't tell you who he was now, argued that when the system is debilitated, as by exhaustion or malnutrition, the tissues of the kidneys in some individuals have a tendency to become flaccid, permitting sugar to seep past. I don't know that his theory was ever proved, but it sounds reasonable, and if there's anything to it, it might explain your case. A boy 19 years of age working 80 to 90 hours a week at carpentry would be constantly on the verge of exhaustion, particularly if he was starving himself so as to save every dollar he could lay his hands on. My guess is that you never had true diabetes, but abused your kidneys until the tissues became flabby enough to leak sugar by the gram, producing symptoms of the true disease at a dangerously advanced stage. Your loss of weight could have been as attributable to malnutrition as to loss of sugar, probably more so. I hope you're right, I told him, but I haven't been overworking or starving myself since I came to Kansas, and I'm still passing sugar. Why would that be? Humph, he snorted irritably. From the day you first came to me, I've never seen you when you weren't tearing into something or other as if you were fighting fire, and that diet you were on kept you undernourished all the while. No wonder you couldn't gain a pound. Furthermore, you can't expect vital organs to function perfectly after they've been badly abused. I'll be surprised if you don't pass a little sugar for the rest of your days. Now, here's what I want you to do for me. Get out of here and run. I don't care where or how fast, but don't come back until you're plumb tuckered out. Dr. DeMay was waiting for me when I came back 2 hours later and seemed delighted that I was so fagged I could hardly keep my balance. He took my blood pressure and listened to my heart and lungs with a stethoscope, then told me, "Well, that didn't do you any harm. Can't see for the life of me why the army turned you down for a leaky heart. There's a slight regurgitation there, but there isn't one man in 40 that has a heart muscle with the strength of that one. And if you don't abuse those lungs, they'll carry you a long, long ways. Now, go in the back room there and leave me a specimen. I'll be surprised if it doesn't have a tale to tell." I'd done as he told me and had been waiting beside his desk 5 or 6 minutes when I heard him chuckling in the back room. After another minute or two, he came out, still chuckling, sat down and slapped me on the knee. "Just as I expected," he told me. "Highest sugar content since I've been treating you." He leaned forward, looked me full in the eyes, and said, "I'd like to tell you right now that, in my opinion, you understand. You're no more likely to die of diabetes than I am. But before I do it, I want to make one more experiment. This next week, I want you to work just as hard as you worked last week. For the first 3 days, you're to stick rigidly to the diet the Boston specialist put you on. For the last 3 days, you're to eat as you have been for the past 3 months. I'm going to give you half a dozen large sample bottles in mailing tubes, and I want you to mail me your entire first specimen every morning. Then, today, a week, I want you back here so after so completely exhausting yourself that you can barely make it up the stairs. Now run along and let me get to work. I've got 40 calls to make before bedtime. One of the most difficult things I ever had to do was get out of McCook without first sending telegrams off to Edna and the folks back home, telling them that it had all been a mistake, that I'd never really had diabetes, that my chances of living to old age were fully as good as the average man's. But it would have been senseless to do anything of the kind before Dr. DeMay was thoroughly satisfied that his diagnosis was correct. To avoid temptation, I stayed in McCook only long enough to buy a dozen cans of salmon, a gallon of sauerkraut, and 5 pounds of gluten flour. Then I headed for Cedar Bluffs as fast as I could drive. I didn't even tell Effie or the miners what Dr. DeMay believed he had discovered, but pitched into the work as hard as I could go. The last heifer Nick had butchered was one of the first I'd bought. She'd been on a corn and alfalfa diet only 10 weeks, but had gained nearly 200 pounds. The beef from any animal fattened that rapidly is bound to be as tender and juicy as a squab. When I started cutting the four quarters that afternoon, I noticed that the fat was white as Carrara marble, and the lean looked as though it were flecked with snowflakes, a sure sign of tenderness and delicious flavor. Probably because I couldn't keep the folks at home out of my mind, I got the idea of sending them one of the loins from that heifer. The weather was cool, Perishable Express should reach Boston in 3 days, and there was little risk that a large piece of pre-chilled meat would spoil in that length of time. I wrapped the 30-pound loin in clean, loosely woven burlap, tagged it with my mother's name and address, raced back to McCook, and got it aboard the eastbound express train. That evening, I wrote to Edna, but found it hard to hold back the news I wanted most to tell her. To keep from it, I wrote nearly 2 pages about George Minor and Effie Simmons, saying that George had been a second father to me and that Effie, old enough to be my mother, had taken me under her wing as if I were an orphan chick. Then I told her about my having been in the cattle and hog feeding business and that I'd gone somewhat in debt when the livestock market broke, but that with advice and help from George and Effie, I was getting myself pulled out of the hole. To fill out the page, I wrote that I'd expressed home the beef loin and asked if she'd drop by and tell my mother that the outside of the piece might become slimy and ill-smelling in shipment, but the trim away an inch all around and the rest would be as sweet and tender as a ripe pear. To avoid mentioning love, I closed my letter, ever and ever, Ralph. The morning I went back to Dr. DeMay's, I exhausted myself so completely by running that I was staggering when I reached his office. He tested and retested a sample of my urine, then slouched down into his big leather swivel chair, clasped his hands behind his head, and rocked contentedly. "Son," he told me, "I've seen many a time when there was a blizzard blowing and I had to make a dozen calls way out on the divide to treat nothing more serious than belly aches, and I knew I'd be lucky to collect $2 for the day's work. Those times a country doctor feels like cussing himself for having gone into the medical profession. But it takes only one case like yours to make up for all the rest of it, over and over again. I'm only a general practitioner, and from a school those best Boston specialists would probably look down their noses at. But I'd stake my life that they were as wrong in their diagnosis as in their prognosis that you could live no more than 6 months. You have incipient diabetes, and probably always will have, but I predict you'll live to dandle away many a grandbaby on your knee. Go on home and live a normal life like any other man, but don't ever forget this. The good God that gave you that body gave you the responsibility of caring for it. No reasonable amount of work will hurt you so long as you balance it with proper nutrition and rest. But another abusing such as you gave yourself during the war could be fatal. You'll have to avoid exhaustion, and for the rest of your life, you should never go more than 3 months without a thorough examination. Now, run along and take care of yourself. Or better still, get a good wife to take care of you. You're at the stage in life where you ought to have a home and family." "That's just what I intend to do," I told him. Thanked him for all he'd done for me, and ran down the stairs 2 at a time. I kept right on running to the depot, intending to send telegrams to Edna and my mother. I had the one to Edna half written when I changed my mind. Her letters had never been more than friendly, and our engagement had been broken because I got hot-headed and threw the ring away, not because my health had failed. I'd been away nearly 3 years, and the chances were 10-1 that she was in love with someone else, if not already engaged to him. But I made a complete jackass of myself. So before I made a complete jackass of myself, I better write my sister Grace and find out how matters stood. When I got home, there were two letters in the mailbox, a thick one from my mother and a thin one from Edna. I ripped the envelope off the thin one and found the letter almost formal, the way people sometimes talk when they're self-conscious. Edna started her letter by telling me she'd been up to my mother's house, that everyone was well, and that the loin of beef had arrived safely. As I had anticipated, it required only a little trimming to remove the shipping damage. My mother had insisted that she take home a big steak, and her parents agreed with her that I was to be congratulated for producing such fine beef. I was most fortunate to have such loyal friends as Mr. Minor and Mrs. Simmons. She was glad I had found a second father in Mr. Minor and knew how gratified I must be at having recovered from my financial reverses. Another paragraph or two about happenings at the church, she closed her letter, as always, sincerely, Edna. I was so disappointed that I stuffed both letters into my pocket, and for the rest of the day, I kept too busy to think about anything but the work I was doing. Nick had gone to the slaughterhouse, and I'd finished washing the supper dishes before I thought of my mother's letter again, so sat down on the back steps and opened it. "Dear son," she wrote, "I have a shameful confession to make. This afternoon, the expressman rapped at my back door, saying he had a shipment of meat addressed to me from Kansas, but that it had spoiled in transit. From where I stood, I could see that the burlap was slimy and the stench was appalling. I marched straight out to the garbage can, took off the cover off, and said, 'You may deliver it right here, right in there, if you will.' He hadn't been gone 20 minutes when Edna came, the first time she's been to our house since she graduated from high school. She said you'd written to her that you had sent home a loin of beef and that the outside might become slightly tainted in shipment, making a little trimming necessary. I told her the meat had arrived, but it had in a hopelessly putrid condition, and where I'd had the expressman delivered. Son, I have never seen such unquestioning confidence. Such unquestioning confidence and loyalty in my life. She told me firmly, but without a trace of rudeness, I can't believe he'd have sent it, or written as he did, unless he'd been sure it would come through all right. Do you mind if I look at it, and would you lend me a butcher knife? Of course, I wouldn't let her do such a thing alone, so when I couldn't persuade her against it, we hauled the ill-smelling bundle out of the garbage can, unwrapped it, and found, just as you expected, that only the surface was the least bit spoiled. In the next two or three paragraphs, Mother told how good the meat was, which of the neighbors she'd given steaks from it, and that she'd insisted upon Edna's taking home a big sirloin. Then she wrote, "I'm sure that her affection for you has never wavered since you were childhood sweethearts. And Gracie tells me that she has never had another steady beau. I pray God for the day when your health has improved enough that you can again ask her to be your wife." I don't remember just what I said to Edna in the letter I wrote her that evening. We've lost it somewhere during the 40-odd years we've been married, but it did the job I wanted it to do. Her only objection was that she didn't want to bring up our children in Beaver Valley, but in a city with fine schools and other cultural advantages. I wanted her so much that I'd have gone anywhere or done anything to make her happy. But the West and horses and cattle had been in my blood from boyhood, and I didn't want the city to be Boston. I tried to write it to her, but couldn't find a way to put it on paper without seeming to be bossy. So I drove to McCook and called her on a long-distance telephone. She understood perfectly, and we compromised on Kansas City, the gateway between East and West, and settled on January 25th, 1922, as our wedding day. That's really cool. Good end of the chapter. Pretty neat how perceptive his mom was, too, to write and help close the loop on that. Anyway, neat that his health has recovered and his diet worked. Love you guys.